Welcome back. Today's suburbs are more racially and economically diverse than many American cities, yet clichés of suburbia continue to abound in American culture. The suburbs are often painted as homogenous, insular communities, little box houses with white picket fences. Well, in her new book, City Lab senior editor Amanda Colson Hurley aims to do away with those stereotypes as she explores the sometimes surprising and radical histories of six suburban communities, among them our own Greenbelt, Maryland, and Reston, Virginia. So, what happens when we rethink who and what the suburbs are for? Amanda Colson Hurley joins us in studio. As I mentioned, she's a senior editor for City Lab and author of the new book, Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
For listeners who are not familiar, can you briefly provide a summary of your new book, Radical Suburbs?
Sure. Well, I think you just recapitulated the kind of, stereotypes of suburbia. And in my book, I dig into the history of American suburbs and find that there's actually a long tradition of people founding experimental communities outside of cities. People who adhered to progressive values and wanted to build experimental new types of communities. And this goes all the way back to the early 19th century. And really, the argument of my book is that we've sort of let our conception of the suburbs or of suburban ways of living and, what suburbs have to look like, we've let that become pretty narrow. And there's no reason it has to be narrow. And historically, there were all sorts of ways to be a suburbanite, all sorts of ways that suburbs could look, and that In those histories, there are actually some really pretty good ideas for the suburbs of the future.
Were there specific suburban stereotypes that you were hoping to re-examine?
Well, yeah, I think some of the ones that you just mentioned. I mean, the homogeneity. I think sometimes people assume that, the suburbs are really for a certain type of person. A person who is usually white and middle class, often married with children, often a certain frame of mind is, I think, also assumed of maybe someone who just likes to kind of conform with, conventional ideas, or someone who's really preoccupied with keeping up with the Joneses. And I certainly found examples where that is not the case in these suburbs where, people were committed to kind of, very strikingly egalitarian ideals.
You talk about suburbs in a lot of places actually growing more diverse. What are the reasons behind that phenomenon?
Well, I mean, I think there are a few reasons. America overall is becoming a more diverse country. We've seen that immigrants to the United States, they used to often, their first stop would be in a city, and then they might, after a while, move out to a suburban community. And increasingly, I think immigrants often just go straight to the suburb of a city. And then I think also, the kind of gentrification phenomenon in cities like D.C., also means that urban real estate is quite expensive, and people are often moving out choosing to leave, whether it's sort of a push or pull factor, but so increasingly we see cities like D.C. Maybe in some cases becoming less diverse or less having a growing white community, and then suburbs, maybe the share of white people in suburbs decreasing.
Your book focuses on six suburban communities, two of which are right here in this region, Greenbelt, Maryland, and Reston, Virginia. Let's start with Greenbelt. Can you talk about the history of that community and why it was once considered so radical?
Yeah. So Greenbelt, it's fascinating because I think a lot of people, even in this region, might sort of have a little inkling that, oh, yeah, Greenbelt, that was sort of a planned community, but they don't really know the history. And it is pretty extraordinary. So Greenbelt was this demonstration town built by the federal government in the 1930s as part of the New Deal. And the original idea of the government planners was to build, dozens of these type of communities around American cities. They really thought that this was sort of the answer to urban problems of that time, specifically crowding and bad housing conditions in cities. They thought if we could build these very modern, rationally planned satellite cities around or satellite towns around big cities, that would solve our problem. And so they took some, New Deal funding. And unfortunately for them, the number of cities that they could build got whittled down from something like 25 originally in the plan to four and then to three. But one of them was Greenbelt. And, it was this, if you go there today, you go to historic Greenbelt, you can see it has this quite striking, very modern architecture for the time, kind of influenced by, by European architecture of the early 20th century. It had, instead of having single family homes, it's attached houses, rows of attached houses and apartments, mid-rise apartment buildings. And it's all kind of very artfully arranged in this half moon shape with this downtown with shops and a community center that used to be an elementary school, kind of right at the heart of it. And it was all very, very carefully planned with a lot of green space. And that was thought to be very helpful for children at the time. So that all seems, maybe it seems, charming now, but at the time it was really quite very progressive.
Well, still, this cooperative community, radical in some ways, was decidedly not so radical in others. Greenbelt was not an integrated community. How did that play out exactly?
That's right. I mean, so on the one hand, it was very progressive and surprising by today's standards, suburban standards, because it was essentially public housing, right? Because it was, the federal government owned the site, and they decided who got to live there. And there was actually an income cap. So they really wanted that housing to be for people who did not have a lot of money. And if you made too much money, you were not allowed to live there. So in that way, it seems quite progressive. But on the other hand, only white families were rented to. They just thought that integrating it was sort of a bridge too far, for 1937 Prince George's County, Maryland. There was a plan to have a separate, African-American community on or near the site, and that got dropped. It sort of presents this kind of double face of, New Deal progressivism, I guess.
And that we got a tweet from RA Scientist who writes, I hope she discusses how suburbia excluded black and brown residents early on. And that's what we're talking about specifically now in terms of Greenbelt. How would you describe Greenbelt today? Did those exclusionary practices have a lasting effect on the community?
Oh, that's a good question. Greenbelt today is, like a lot of D.C. area suburbs, very diverse. There's a large African-American population. There are communities, people with roots in Africa and Central America. And Greenbelt itself is much bigger than that historic Greenbelt area that the federal government initially founded. I think the historic part of Greenbelt does skew still a little bit, at least a little bit whiter than the other areas of the town. So I suppose you could, that might be a trace effect that lingers from that early segregationist pattern. Yeah.
How would you describe Greenbelt today?
Greenbelt as a whole or historic Greenbelt?
Historic Greenbelt.
Historic Greenbelt. I find it a tantalizing vision of a suburban future that never happened. I guess I would put it like that.
Could you read an excerpt about Greenbelt from the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
The book is called Radical Suburbs.
Boys on bikes whiz past a gleaming white modernist building. The path dips below a road and they emerge on the other side into a park where tall trees shield rows of houses. Welcome to Greenbelt, Maryland, the most potent symbol of the path not taken in suburban development in the United States. A first-time visitor today might describe Greenbelt as cute or sweet. In its small Art Deco downtown are whitewashed buildings with gracefully rounded corners, housing a movie theater, nail salon, grocery store, and restaurants. Time has whittled its ambitions down to a historical footnote. On a closer look, the place is a bit uncanny, a postcard from a future that failed to materialize.
Reading Amanda Colson Hurley, reading from her book. It's called Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City. What do you mean by a future that failed to materialize? What happened to Greenbelt?
Well, you know, I think the vision that the planners had was that this was going to be a model for a smarter, better, more egalitarian way to build suburbs, for cities to expand, right? It was going to be inclusive of people with low incomes. It was going to be very efficient because people lived in kind of smaller houses and had a lot of shared space rather than everybody having their own house with their own kind of lot and yard. But that model just didn't take off. And I think there's a number of factors you can point to, but I think, the big one is that after the Second World War, not long after Greenbelt was completed, you had home builders like the Levitts, say, who were famous for building the Levitt towns, who were able to kind of use these mass production techniques and apply them to building very large suburbs of single-family homes very fast and they were able to sell them at a pretty cheap price. And that was the model as well that the federal government really backed. At that point, they really backed away from the government being involved in this kind of town building and, also in subsidizing housing like that. And they really wanted the private market to take over and to take the lead on that. And so that was the model that prevailed.
Here's Sarah in Columbia, Maryland. Sarah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'm out in the northern suburbs, mid Montgomery County suburbs. And I've lived in this area for half a century or so, and I've seen quite a lot of changes. I mean, Georgia Avenue used to be one lane in each direction, and now it's four at some point. And when I was helping with my children's international program about a decade ago at our local elementary school, you were talking about diversity. Well, at that time, we had 30 different countries represented by the families that lived in my neighborhood.
Was that neighborhood in Silver Spring or in Columbia?
Neither. It's out in Brookville, Olney, Ashton area.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons I moved back to the Washington area after college, is because there was so much diversity when I was growing up in this area. I had friends from five different countries in my crowd of friends. And when I was out in Pennsylvania, it was all WASP and all white and no diversity. And I didn't like that. And I came back to this area because of the diversity here. I will tell you, though, that I have seen some major changes since I was a baby. And there was a country club neighborhood built that in its covenant said no Jews or blacks are allowed to live here. That's all changed in the last 50 years. And everyone and anyone is allowed to live in that community now.
Okay.
So, yeah, in the last 50 years, I've seen a lot of changes, but I definitely came back here because of the diversity. I wanted to raise my family where it was diverse.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. Sarah is calling from Columbia, Maryland, and Columbia will come up after we take this short break and we start talking about Reston, Virginia. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. Our guest is Amanda Colson Hurley. She's a senior editor for City Lab. We're talking about her new book. It's called Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City. First, let's go out to Prince George's County, where EW awaits us. EW, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call, Kojo. I've seen a new trend, and I must say I've probably been a resident of the county all of my life, with a few one exception of moving away. When I was growing up, you had malls like Landover Mall, White Flint, and those malls have become antiquated. Then we went to the outdoor town center where you can walk around. What I've seen lately is shopping centers being insulated with housing built around it, like at Glenard and Woodmore, the Wegmans. You got some maybe close to a couple of thousand residents that live within walking distance. They've built townhouses around it, and I've seen that also off of South Dakota over by that Costco. You're probably familiar with Costco. Yep. I mean, Kojo. So I'm thinking, is that a new trend? That's more of a question. Is that something that's been done in the past and they're just bringing it back? Or is that something that's new? Like, for your author to be able to answer that.
Amanda.
That's a great question. I think that's definitely a trend that we're seeing now. Columbia came up earlier in the show, and Columbia is a place where they're adding a lot of apartments to, in and around the mall site in downtown Columbia. We also see that at places like White Flint, up Brockville Pike. They're adding apartments to what had been just a kind of a strip mall, and pretty tall apartment buildings. I mean, a pretty intensive development. So that's definitely a trend right now. Is it new? I mean, I think it's at that scale, it's new. But I mean, you can trace it back to places like Reston. That's actually a good segue to Reston.
What was the idea behind Reston?
The idea behind Reston, I think the quickest and easiest way to sum it up is sort of that it would be an anti-suburb. It was developed by Bob Simon, Robert E. Simon, who was a pretty interesting person. He was born into this real estate developer family in New York. His formative experience was taking a bicycle trip around Europe as a young man and biking around and seeing these plazas where people were sitting out and, having their coffee and talking to their neighbors and seeing how people were so comfortable. They lived kind of right on top of each other, but, they were comfortable and there was such a sense of community there. And he was really inspired by this. And so his family owned a share of Carnegie Hall in New York, and he sold that to raise the capital to build this new town, this kind of new type of suburb that wasn't really a suburb in Northern Virginia. And people thought he was nuts. It was way out by Dulles Airport. There was really nothing out there but farmland at the time. And people thought this was a huge gamble. He kind of said, wait and see, this area is going to grow. And he was right. It was a good bet.
Columbia, Maryland follows a similar model. What's the connection between Reston and Columbia?
Well, Reston and Columbia were built by and imagined by different people, but they were a few years apart. Reston came a couple of years before Columbia. And I know that the men were kind of aware of the plans and the goings on, of the other one in each place. But they were separate developments. They definitely share a lot of commonalities. I think both Bob Simon in Reston and Jim Rouse in Columbia were really dissatisfied by the suburban development that they saw taking place around them. They thought it was soulless. They thought it was ugly. It, was not respectful of nature. And they really thought that they could do it better and create communities that really nurtured people and kind of nurtured people, through every stage of their life.
But unlike Greenbelt, Reston was integrated from the start.
Yes, as was Columbia. Yes.
What effect did integration have on that suburban Virginia community?
Well, I mean, it was very interesting to read about as I did my research, and that Bob Simon was from New York, and he always claimed later that he didn't put a lot of thought into Reston being integrated. He just said, well, you know, the idea that it wouldn't be just kind of never occurred to me. Of course it would be open to whoever wanted to move there. But, you know, this was 1965. It was before the Loving case. I mean, so it was definitely not typical for Virginia at the time. And so, there apparently realtors in Northern Virginia and other parts of Northern Virginia would kind of sometimes tell home buyers, well, you know, there's Reston, but, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you don't want to live there. I mean, that's what they would tell white home buyers, kind of. So there was definitely, it was definitely not an automatic step to take at that time.
Could you read another excerpt from Radical Suburbs about Reston?
Sure. Carrying on the vision of Greenbelt, Reston anticipated the rediscovery of walkable urbanism and mixed-use development by decades. After an early and close brush with failure, it has grown and prospered. But now its residents are engaged in a bitter fight over its future. The question it faces, and that more and more suburbs will face in coming years, is one of identity. Should Reston remain a suburb or become a city?
So glad you mentioned that, because that battle is reflected in the call we're getting from Julia in Reston, Virginia. Julia, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. My name actually is Juliet, and my last name is Rossant. My father, James Rossant, of the firm Conklin Rossant, was the master planner of Reston, and he also designed all the architecture of Lake Ann, which is the original village center. And so I did not grow up here. I grew up in New York City, where many of the ideas of what Reston was to become came from. The suburb where my father grew up, right outside New York City, was a walkable green suburb. And even though Reston's really forward-thinking, it also harkened to the past. There's a word my father used a lot that I think is important to raise in this conversation, which is loitering. In fact, loitering was against the law, and he intentionally added loitering as something you could do in Reston. And that was created by having pathways, these little village centers, which Greenbelt had as well, where the people who live here had to get out of their cars, had to walk around, bicycle, and encounter each other. And
that seems to be changing. You know, Julia, we don't have a great deal of time left, so I'd like to get your response to this, because at the time that Amanda was writing this book, some Reston residents had been fighting a proposal to raise the density cap from 13 to 15 people per acre. How do you feel about that?
I'm actually very against it. I live right next in Reston, right next to the golf course, another large green area. I don't want to see Reston become just another Arlington, really dense. It should be preserved, and why not? We need this kind of suburbs around. This actually physically makes you and mentally makes you a happier, calmer person. Okay. When I moved with my five-year-old from D.C. here, he himself described how much happier he was in a place where...
Okay, so you're against the increase of density. As I said, we don't have a great deal of time left, but there's one more passage from the book I'd like you to read.
Oh, sure. And that was great to hear from the original architect's daughter, by the way. I just love the architecture at Lake Ann. Okay. Today, segregation by race and class is turning the hinterlands of many cities into patchwork quilts of white and brown, have and have not. Affluent whites often sort themselves into the neighborhoods with the best public schools and the highest, most stable property values. Surrounding these neighborhoods is a force field that prevents change, exclusionary zoning. By banishing lower-cost housing from the area, incumbent homeowners push less advantaged people, who are often not white, to neighborhoods with worse schools, worse access to jobs, fewer parks and stores and services.
So what would happen if exclusionary zoning laws were amended?
Well, I think a lot of benefits could be seen, by by a lot of people, by all of us, really, if that were to happen. I think that I live in Montgomery County, and, you know, there I see there's some momentum now to make it easier to build accessory dwelling units, which is sort of, you know, a basement or garage apartment or a backyard cottage in your on your property. And I think that's a great idea. I think that that is sort of a, you know, an organic and kind of small scale source of more affordable housing that can let, you know, existing homeowners, it can help them, you know, say supplement their Social Security if they're older, if they can take on a tenant that way, and then obviously provide more affordable housing to people who need it because our urban areas are growing.
But our last caller said she doesn't want Reston to be like Arlington. And Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst on the Politics Hour, tweets, both Tysons Corner and Crystal City National Landing are trying to remake themselves into urban centers. When do we stop calling them suburban?
That's a great question. Yeah. And it's one that's sort of bedeviled me as I've worked on this project. And then people say, well, you know, how do you define suburban, or what is the line between suburban and urban? I think we're kind of moving toward what, and it's a big mouthful of jargon, but academics call it polycentric urbanism, right? But it's this idea that, you know, you don't really have, you know, this city like a bullseye kind of ringed by low density suburbs, but, you know, you really have, it's more like a kind of constellation of different kind of urban centers or urban nodes around a region like the Washington region, you know, connected by roads and by houses and suburban communities. So I think we're kind of heading toward that model, like it or not. But I mean, I can certainly sympathize with Juliet's concern about, you know, wanting to have that connection to nature. I think that's one reason that a lot of people are drawn to a suburban setting. And I think it's important to find a way to preserve that, you know, even amid further development. Yeah.
Amanda Colson-Hurley, she is a senior editor for City Lab and author of the new book, Radical Suburbs, Experimental Living on the Fringes of the American City. Amanda Colson-Hurley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show on Suburbia was produced by Julie Deppenbrock, and our conversation on D.C.'s International Film Festival was produced by Mark Gunnery. Coming up tomorrow, we'll get a preview on this weekend's National Anti-Racist Book Festival, the first event of its kind to feature writers focused on combating racism with policy. Plus, we'll look at local sports leagues' policies regarding gender and team sports, and we'll examine how transgender athletes are navigating them. That all starts tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Bruce Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorff, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.